Well, thanks for joining us. I'm Derek McGinty, filling in for Diane Rehm. And if you are just a tad bleary-eyed this morning, we understand that GOP debate on Fox Business Channel ran long and late last night, but at least it was not boring. In fact, it was a bit of a political gunfight with much of the ammunition spent on the guy who wasn't there, President Barack Obama, who this week delivered his final State of the Union address. Meantime, in Michigan, they're asking for federal disaster relief as the water has too much lead in it, and some suspect it also has the bacteria that causes Legionnaire's disease. And, of course, there's the U.S. stock market, which is already open for today and not looking good. In fact, this is the worst New Year's start ever for the markets, and some experts are talking recession. We've got our own experts here in the studio for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. Naftali Ben-David of the Wall Street Journal, Susan Glasser of Politico, and Reed Wilson of the Morning Consult. I want to welcome all of you here with me. I'm Derek McGinty. And, of course, we can't wait to hear what your listeners think about last night's debate and everything else on this quite long list of topics today. The number is 800-433-8850, 800-433-8850. You can also send us your email at drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. And because it is Friday, we're doing that live video stream of this hour, so you can watch it at drshow.org. Hey, guys.
Hi, morning. There.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right. Everybody knows about the slugfest between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz last night. Very entertaining. But I was also struck by what I call the rise of the establishment guys. Fewer candidates meant Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, and John Kasich got more time and seemed to do pretty well. Not Tommy?
Yeah, I wouldn't underestimate, actually, the significance of having seven candidates on the stage instead of ten. On the one hand, seven still sounds like a lot, but it's just that much less time that you have to battle for. And I thought nobody had really a bad night last night. I think they continue to have the problem that there are four of them, depending on how you count it, and it's just very difficult for anyone to emerge. I thought Chris Christie had his moments and Jeb Bush did, but ultimately it's very hard to emerge when you have that kind of a cluster.
What do you think?
Well, you know, Naftali, I agree with you very much about the difficulty of breaking through at this point, but a couple of quick observations. First of all, it was Ted Cruz was just on a different playing field at this point. He really has emerged with much more confidence and authority as he's risen in the polls and looks to be potentially leading in Iowa at this point. He really was very confident. He came out very, very aggressive in jabbing Donald Trump and pushing back, ironically, against the birtherism. He didn't mind it when it was birtherism about Barack Obama. Now he thinks it's a disqualifying thing for Donald Trump to be saying. That being said, there was somebody who had a bad night. Let's all agree. Dr. Ben Carson,
goodness.
The surge isn't happening. In our insider survey of key early state insiders, one of them said, this is starting to look like Admiral Stockdale territory. Remember him? The guy who ran with Ross Perot?
Why am I here? Who am I and why am I here? I ask the question personally when I'm watching Ben Carson, does he still care about what's going on? It's hard to tell, Reed.
One of the things that what I saw last night was two pairs who were attacking each other for various different reasons, in that they all want supremacy in early states. Donald Trump and Ted Cruz trying to win Iowa. It's a close race, according to the most recent surveys that have come out. And then Chris Christie and Marco Rubio, who are really fighting over trying to win that establishment mantle and make a big statement in New Hampshire. Then of the three other people, Jeb Bush just sort of looks lost on stage. Like, he doesn't understand the political calculus of today. And I think John Kasich is running a great campaign for 2000. Ooh. It's not a campaign for 2016. This Republican Party has sort of evolved away from remember when John Kasich was Paul Ryan before Paul Ryan was Paul Ryan. And then Ben Carson.
If you listen to John Kasich, every statement begins with, well, you know, I did used to be budget chairman, and I am governor of this very important state, and I've done these things before, and that's his selling point, and it's just not selling.
And experience doesn't sell these days in politics like it has in the past. Look at Jeb Bush, a two-term governor. John Kasich, a two-term governor who spent, 18 years in Congress, by the way, as chair of the budget committee, a guy who actually knows about balancing the federal budget. That doesn't count anymore. What counts is new and different, and the change that that I think people so desperately seek, and that's not good for a candidate who's been around the national stage for
decades. You've got to give John Kasich, I guess, credit for sticking with his strategy, though. Maybe that's the only strategy he's got. Let's get back to Trump and Cruz, however. As I say, very entertaining to watch them go at each other. It seemed to go back and forth. Is there a sense of who came out on top on this?
Well, my sense was that Cruz was sort of, in a way, the dominant figure of the night, to tell you the truth. On the one hand, he was taking on Donald Trump, whether it was about the birtherism issue, whether it was about New York values, whatever those are. And he also was taking on Marco Rubio, in a sense, from his other side. And they got into it about immigration, about taxes. He just had this dominant feel. He also came off as a trained debater, as a guy who knows exactly what he's doing. It was not surprising that the guy had been a debater. But more broadly about the debate, the thing that struck me was this almost apocalyptic vision of America that was being talked about. It was a great contrast to the president's State of the Union earlier in the week, where he'd been trying to take a more positive tone. But, I mean, they were talking about an America in decline, beset by economic insecurity, beset by you know, military insecurity, just an America that they don't recognize anymore. And that really jumped out, I thought.
Well, Naftali, I do agree with you. I think that has been a running theme throughout the primary season so far, is the sort of the red America, which is one of almost, you know, Armageddon-like decline. On the other hand, you have this split-screen thing happening with President Obama and his State of the Union address, which was by the way, not quite full-throated defense of all the change. That was the biggest word that he used. All the change that he's accomplished over the course of his two terms in office. So you really do have this sense that there's a narrative for the Republicans, there's a narrative for the Democrats, and they don't meet. But Derek asked the question about Trump v. Cruz and who won. I agree with you that on point overall, Cruz had an authority and a mastery of the stage that no one else touched. However, Donald Trump, after every single other debate, except for this debate, he was really judged to be the loser, at least by the pundit class. That didn't stop his rise in the polls. This time, no one said that Trump lost. It was his best debate performance. He had a very un-Trump-like, almost statesman-like invocation of New York after 9/11. It wasn't really apropos of anything. It didn't really match up with anything else he said. And actually, it was strikingly discordant with how Donald Trump spoke the rest of the evening. But it really did stand out as a moment for Donald Trump that he has not conjured up right now. And right now, remember, he's trying to convince people in the Republican Party who've watched this spectacle up until now as an amusement park theatrics, hey, if I'm actually going to win, I've got to make people comfortable enough, not super comfortable, but comfortable enough with the idea that I can be the party's nominee. And that 9/11 moment kind of did that.
This was the final debate before the Iowa caucuses. So where do we go from here? I mean, how do you feel the political strategies will line up over the next couple of weeks, Reid?
Well, I think the Republican Party has gone through three phases of Donald Trump, if you will, to Susan's point. There's sort of the stage of denial, the stage of anger slash bargaining, if you will. There was the denial that he was a real candidate, that he would play a big role in this race, and then he jumped to the top of the polls, and he stayed there for 6 months. There was the anger and bargaining phase. We heard a lot of Republican strategists trying to come up with the money necessary to run a bunch of negative ads against him. Those ads haven't showed up. Now we're in, I don't know if we call it the acceptance phase, but we're getting close to that point where some senior Republicans are telling all of us that hey, Donald Trump might actually be the nominee. These are, you know, the people who ran the previous presidential campaigns are now saying, boy, we could have Donald Trump as an actual nominee.
And they're asking themselves, do I like Donald Trump or do I like Ted Cruz?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think having Donald Trump in the race has made Ted Cruz in some ways seem a little bit more palatable. You know, he's sometimes...
Well, perhaps the other way around for some.
Well, depends who you talk to. But I mean, he sort of, there's this, you know, been desire on the part of the Republican establishment for Trump support to fall away. But it's not clear that it would fall away to anybody except Ted Cruz. And then they'd end with him. I'm not sure who they think would benefit. But if you look further ahead at the way the primaries line up, there are several primaries earlier on that would be easier for Ted Cruz to win. They tend to be southern primaries, more conservative states. And then after that, you get to states that would be a little bit less in his territory. So you could see a situation play out where there's a bit of a surge for a Trump or a Cruz, and then later in the campaign, the battle is for if any establishment figure can close that gap.
Let me just bring up one thing real quick on this other states down the line. that get to vote, the people who are going to vote in those Republican primaries are still Republicans, and they're still conservatives. A field poll, the California's Best poll, just came out a couple of days ago that shows Ted Cruz leading in California. Mm. And those are the states, you know, whether it's Massachusetts or California. They still get to send delegates to the national convention, despite the fact that they're going to vote Democratic in November. And when they do, I don't see a lot of clear evidence that Cruz can't win those primaries.
Well, which is why it is a mistake to just only talk about the primary process. If we pull out to talk about the general election, the picture looks pretty different. Remember that Donald Trump is polling. His lead consists of a minority party, and the question of who's going to even turn out. That means that the vast majority of Americans are not only unlikely to vote for Donald Trump if he emerges as the nominee, but there's an extent to which the party being pushed so far to its fringes is certainly something that the strategists in Brooklyn at Hillary Clinton's headquarters are not looking upon with dismay. We had a really interesting glimpse into this fight for the soul of the Republican Party in a story that we broke late last night. The RNC was having its winter meetings, coincidental with these debates, and a committee man stood up and video was taken, and he said, "Guys, we're being terrorized here, literally terrorized. You are forcing us to toe the line. You're trying to tell us it's okay that we can accept Donald Trump as our nominee. What are you kidding? This is crazy. It's going to be the end of our party. Can't somebody, you know, tell the truth?" This sort of cri de coeur, which, by the way, fell on deaf ears.
We've got to take a break. I'm Derek McGinty, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. This is the domestic hour of our Friday news roundup. I'm Derek McGinty, in for Diane, and here in the studio with me, Naftali Ben-David, editor and reporter at The Wall Street Journal, Susan Glasser, editor of Politico, and Reed Wilson, Congress editor and chief political correspondent at Morning Consult. The number here is 800-433-8850. So let's take a phone call or two. Frank in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air. Go ahead, Frank. Frank, are you there?
Could you hear me?
Yep, now I can.
Okay, I was a little troubled yesterday that, you know, when they were talking about how the president was taking our economy backward, but if you look at the numbers, unemployment in 2000 was 4%, okay? And then it started to increase all the way into 2009, and the Republicans were in charge from 2000 to 2006. They actually took us to 2009 with the unemployment of whatever it was. And once health care was passed, whether that was a solution to the unemployment dropping, it stabilized and started to increase after it passed. Okay, and our economy, what happened to it was the cause of a Republican president, a Republican Congress, and a Republican Senate.
Well, that's certainly the argument from the other side of the aisle, but it wasn't going to get much traction last night, was it, Naftali?
No, and we had this sort of stark contrasting tableaus this week where you have the president portraying a much more positive view of the United States economically and militarily than the Republicans. And the truth is, I mean, it's right that there has been a sustained recovery in many ways. There's been job growth. There's been a fall in unemployment. No one could discount that. On the other hand, wages haven't gone up, and there's a lot of anxiety, and there's a lot of struggle in the economy, and it has not been a clear, uninterrupted, smooth recovery. And so it's been volatile, and so you have these starkly different portraits. And I think both in their different ways, the Republicans and President Obama tried to seize on that this week.
Is there something ironic about the GOP selling itself as now the champion of the working man?
Well, you know, Republican populism has been around for a long time. However, we haven't really elected a lot of Republican populists to office in recent years. And I do think that that's part of what makes this rift inside the party so very interesting. You have people who you'd never call populists and working man's people, though John Kasich did his very best to talk about his roots in Pittsburgh, to make it clear his dad didn't wear a white collar, unlike Jeb Bush's father and some of the others up on the stage. And by the way, unlike Donald Trump's, let's talk about the irony of a billionaire who has emerged as an angry populist in this campaign.
You know, I got an email from Almina, which speaks to just what you're talking about. It says, if you gave Kasich as much airtime as you do Trump and Cruz, he might be doing better. Why do all the media focus on the fringes, Reed?
Well, I don't know that the media focuses on the candidates who are leading. And it is, you know, Donald Trump didn't lead because he got more time in a debate. Ted Cruz has arguably increased his standing by leaps and bounds because of his performances in various debates. As Naftali said, he's a talented debater and has demonstrated that over and over again. But Ted Cruz is building his lead, especially in Iowa, because of his appeal to a very specific slice of the Republican electorate, to Christian evangelicals. The difference in airtime, if you actually take a look at the minutes and seconds that they all get to speak, isn't that great. I mean, it's a matter of a few minutes. A few minutes of John Kasich talking is not going to change, fundamentally alter the Republican race.
Let's talk about the Democratic race for just a minute. Up until now, in the last week or two, Hillary Clinton was pretty much assumed that she was going to walk into this thing pretty easily. But she was always down in New Hampshire because that's a home, basically almost a home state for Bernie Sanders. But now in Iowa, where she had a big advantage, that advantage has dried up. What's gone wrong for Hillary Clinton?
Well, you know, remember, Iowa was the state that humbled her back in 2008 when she ran against Barack Obama and was in a, thought to be in a similarly commanding position. Hillary Clinton is not a tailor-made candidate for Iowa. People are now starting to talk about the enthusiasm gap, which, by the way, is, I believe, almost verbatim the phrase that was used 8 years ago. And so there must be a sense of deja vu haunting things. From what I understand, Clinton has a much stronger campaign on the ground this time around in Iowa. She's much better organized. They've been conscious from the beginning that the campaign was starting out in a state that wasn't friendly territory to her. They drew an unlucky luck of the draw, basically, with Sanders as her only significant opponent, because otherwise New Hampshire would have been solidly in Clinton's corner. So I think you could very well have a scenario where she emerges very bloodied coming out of these first two states. That doesn't necessarily mean that it changes the outcome of the Democratic race, but it's going to be one of those. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, for that matter, have given us almost a lifetime's worth of political roller coasters. It's very, very likely that Clinton is going to be rolling down that one before she rolls back up.
And Naftali, how much trouble is she in?
Well, I think long term, she's not in a huge amount of trouble. She's always struggled with a candidate who can generate more passion and more devotion and people willing to knock on doors. She's always been somebody who's broadly popular in the party but doesn't have the same intensity that some of the other candidates can generate, whether it's Barack Obama or Bernie Sanders. And I think the campaign is starting to face the question of, what if she loses Iowa and New Hampshire? How bad is that going to be? And it won't be great, and no candidate likes that sign of vulnerability. But the truth is, the states further down are probably better for her, and I'm sure she can then position herself as the comeback kid, just like her husband did. And my sense is this isn't a great moment for the campaign, but probably not anything close to a fatal one.
Let's take another phone call. Martha in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, my goodness, thank you for taking this question, because it's frustrating me. I'm somebody who really believes Ted Cruz is not eligible to be president because he was born in Canada. I know the comparison to John McCain, but John McCain had two American parents and was born in another country. Ted Cruz only had one parent who was American and born in another country. Does that mean all those Amerasian children that were left behind in Vietnam are technically American citizens who are eligible to run for president? The thing with... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't know that anyone here is a constitutional or legal expert on who's eligible to vote and who's not. But
when they were complaining about Obama, I kept saying to people, you know, the uterus has to be in Kenya for him to have been born in Kenya. And there was never any proof his mother was there.
Well,
so I'm just...
All right, let's talk about this.
I mean, leaving uteruses out of it for the moment. I mean, I think this is an issue that when it first came up, a lot of us shrugged off that it was sort of one of these things that Donald Trump tosses off. How could anybody take it seriously? I think in the past few days, we've seen that both legal scholars and other politicians are at least admitting that it's not completely settled law. But I think that said, if the Supreme Court is not in any way going to disqualify an elected president of the United States unless it absolutely has to, because the law is 100% clear. So the likelihood that something really happening, like Ted Cruz winning and then somehow facing a serious challenge, I think, is minimal. And in a way, it's minimal, you know, precisely because the law is unsettled and the Supreme Court isn't going to choose that opportunity to do so. So I think as that kind of a legal issue, it's probably moot. But it does seem to be striking some doubt in some people's minds.
And Trump's not letting it go.
No, and it's something he does very well.
Well, I did love the irony of Donald Trump citing Lawrence Tribe in the middle of the debate stage.
So there's an actual part of the U.S. Code that deals with the definition of a natural-born citizen. It is Title 8, Chapter 12, Subchapter 3, Section 1401.
I take back what I said about nobody here being
somebody,
a legal expert.
A friend of mine emailed that to me. I can't claim credit for it. But it does, in fact, lay out a number of requirements that would make somebody a natural-born citizen or not. You know, again, I am not a constitutional scholar, so I can't say, and I'm not a Ted Cruz scholar, so I can't say whether or not he meets those criteria. But we have had a number of nominees who have not been born in the United States. John McCain was born in a U.S. territory in Panama. Barry Goldwater was born in Arizona before Arizona was a state, when it was still a territory. So that at least has happened. I don't mean to suggest that Canada is a territory of ours that we're about to annex, but you know, who knows? This is the point, though, is that this is an issue that has come up. It is now in the political bloodstream in Iowa, and at a moment when Ted Cruz just sort of last week looked like he was running away with Iowa, now the most recent Iowa poll conducted for the Des Moines Register shows that it's a much closer race. So something is tempering Cruz's growth. Maybe it's this.
Let's get to the president and his State of the Union address this past week. He was obviously trying to lay out his version of a legacy. And we had Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, say, well, the president obviously is delusional. He sees things as he wishes they were rather than how they are. How successful do you think he was, though, in telling America, this is what I've done? And we should be proud of a lot of this.
Well, I think he was successful in sort of injecting that back into the conversation. I don't think he was successful in changing the minds of the people who've been critical of him. It was remarkable. I mean, you know, last night I think Chris Christie called it something like story time with Barack Obama. I mean, these were two such starkly different portraits of the country that really sort of took you aback a little bit. I mean, this was not a typical State of the Union address. Usually there's this long list of initiatives, and people inside and outside the government spend months trying to get one sentence in the State of the Union that backs up their cause. This was not like that. The president, I think, was trying to do two things. One is create sort of a bookend of his presidency, hark back to some of his early themes and messages and talk about how he feels like they've gone. And the other really was to present a counterpoint to the Republican campaign. He quoted language very specifically that the Republican candidates have been doing. And it's a remarkable thing to see a president using that pulpit to deliver that kind of a message in what seemed to be a direct rebuke of what was happening in the other party's primary campaign.
Well, I don't think it was an accident that Obama started out making a joke about Iowa and whether the Republican candidates wanted to get off of the floor of Congress and get back there. He said, I know a thing or two about it if you'd like to talk to me. He's really feeling the campaign this time, although I was struck by the fact that this was an anti-Republican speech. It was not a pro-Hillary Clinton speech. Mm. And I think that's very important. Clearly, Obama is not really putting his thumb on the scale for Clinton at this point, as much as, if anything, he's striking certain themes that Bernie Sanders is more associated with. But he's really, really peeved about this angry, unhappy America in decline narrative that the Republicans are portraying in the campaign this year.
Well, the most interesting thing to me was the Nikki Haley response, the governor of South Carolina, who, after, you know, saying the obligatory "we don't like Obama" business at the top, said a lot of the same things he said about the angry voices dominating the debate on the GOP.
And on social media, on Facebook and Twitter, the moment of the State of the Union that generated the most comments, the most interactions, was that President Obama talking about the anti-Muslim sentiment that we tend that some of the Republican candidates are tending to fall into. What has struck me about this speech is that, and by the way, the last sort of week or two, is that we've got two people who are not in the 2016 race who are very much trying to inject themselves into the race. And on one hand, you've got President Obama, who is trying to portray this optimistic vision of the country after his 8 years in office. And by the way, his coalition, the younger voters, minority voters, are much more likely to see that optimistic vision, to Naftali's point about sort of the dichotomy of American public opinion these days. On the other person who's trying to inject himself into this race is Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. First time he was sitting behind President Obama as the Speaker, and he has tried to make the point that Congress is not going to lie down. Usually in a presidential year, you don't hear much from Congress. They prepare to run their own campaigns in conjunction with their party's presidential nominee. Paul Ryan is signaling that he actually wants to try to do some things, make Congress actually work, and pass some legislation.
Reed Wilson is Congress editor and chief political correspondent at Morning Consult. Susan Glasser is the editor of Politico, and Naftali Ben-David is editor and reporter at The Wall Street Journal. I'm Derek McGinty, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's get back to our phones, if we might. Derek in Louisville, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I was just kind of curious on the panel's thoughts on the poll that was taken earlier in the week, that the information was held out and actually held Rand Paul out of the debate. If that poll had been added, he would have been tied with Jeb Bush. And then also how he kind of took on social media and was the trending candidate for the majority of the debate, even though he wasn't even there.
Susan Glasser?
Well, you know, the caller is right. This didn't get very much attention. We wrote this story. But basically, if the poll had just been released literally a few minutes later, this survey appeared to have been taken within the rules set by Fox, within the time period set by Fox for polls that would consider these things. It knocked Rand off the stage. He declined to participate in the undercard debate. I don't know if you noticed at the very end, if you stuck with this debate, it ended way after 11 o'clock at night. So there, you might not have, but there was a little bit of audience disruption, shouting Rand, 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 well after 11 o'clock last night. That being said, what I think about the Rand Paul candidacy, remember back a year ago or even 2 years ago, this is a lesson for all of us in the perils of political conventional wisdom. Rand Paul, the most interesting man in politics, has disappeared into an asterisk in this Republican contest. He's very likely to drop out after the Iowa caucuses.
He did, however, have an interesting moment drinking bourbon on The Daily Show with the host there doing his one-man debate.
But the truth is, my guess is that his father is going to be remembered as the more successful Paul presidential candidate in the family.
All right, let's get to this email, which comes our way from Rob, who says, Donald Trump getting the GOP nomination will not kill the Republican Party. It will simply confirm what we already know, that the party of the establishment is already dead. We conservatives have had enough of Republicans in name only and Democrat light.
Which is fascinating because he's talking about a candidate who has voiced support for a single-payer health care system. He's a candidate who has donated to Hillary Clinton and the Clintons writ large. And Donald Trump, he is tapping into something, and it is it's this sort of anger that voters like the emailer sort of feel at the Republican establishment. They feel lied to. They feel like they've been lied to during the George W. Bush administration. Remember, the rise of the Tea Party didn't start with President Obama. It started with compassionate conservatism in 2006 and 2008 when voters finally had enough with George W. Bush. So Trump is sort of the outlet for this rage, even if he isn't the perfect outlet ideologically, because a lot of his previous policy positions don't adhere to what I think we all would define as conservatism.
And I mean, that anger is something that has benefited the Republican Party in many ways. It gave them a majority in the House. It gave them a majority in the Senate. And the question is now whether that's ultimately going to come back to haunt them. And these things are coming back to roost. And I think that's the thing that worries the establishment so much. I mean, if you saw, we talked about Nikki Haley's response. I mean, that was the voice of the Republican establishment. It was the face, literally and figuratively, that they want to put forward. And it was striking how similar her message was to President Obama's. I mean, things she said like, well, if we lower the volume, you can hear the other side more clearly. That could have been taken right from his speech.
And she also said, Republicans are at least in part to blame for the gridlock in Washington.
She did. She said that very specifically. She said, we as Republicans have to own that. And you saw this immediate, fierce, angry backlash. And that highlighted the split and the almost war that's taking place in the Republican Party as well as anything else has.
Well, remember, this is a war. It was just a few months ago, in fact, that the revolution did eat its own. And the Republican conservatives in Congress, the Freedom Caucus, forced out their own speaker, John Boehner, who came to Congress, by the way, as a revolutionary insurgent in the 1990s.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get to that water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Not the kind of thing you expected to see in this country. We'll talk about it. Stay with us. This is the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Derek McGinty in for Diane Rehm on our Friday News Roundup, and I'm joined in studio here by Naftali Ben-David, editor and reporter at The Wall Street Journal, Susan Glasser, the editor of Politico, and Reed Wilson, Congress editor and chief political correspondent at Morning Consult. Our phone number is 800-433-8850, and of course you can send email to at drshow at wamu.org. I'm curious about this story out in Michigan where they're actually having to have the National Guard hand out water because there's too much lead, and it all seems to stem from the fact that they had to change how they handle their water because of financial problems in the state, Reed.
So here's what happened. A couple of years ago, 2 years ago, when Michigan was going through an economic crisis, you might remember there was an emergency coordinator who had to come in and take over Detroit because its economic situation, budgetary situation, was so bad. In Flint, they switched the way they were receiving their water. They, instead of pulling water out of Lake Huron, they pulled it out of the Flint River. And the Flint River, after years of industrial contamination, is kind of a lousy place to get your drinking water. That water has had a lot of sort of caustic substances in it and a lot of iron and extremely elevated lead levels. And so now, after 2 years, 18 months, of denying that there was any problem with the water, the state has acknowledged that there is a significant problem with the water, with the number of children who are showing elevated lead levels, and lead is really, really bad for you, especially in your drinking water. Now they have called in the National Guard. Rick Snyder, the governor, has asked President Obama for an emergency declaration, and because of that, this is going to end up in a lot of courts, and a lot of people are going to get a lot of money, and it's probably going to cost the state a lot more than it would have to just continue pumping water out of Lake Huron.
The criticism of the governor, and then what they're investigating now as well, is that he, as you say, denied it was a problem for a long time and therefore allowed perhaps people to get sick.
It is a question of who knew what when, who knew how bad the water was when, what did the Department of Environmental Regulation, whatever the Michigan version of it is called, what they actually did, how they treated the water, and the answer appears to be they didn't treat it with the right chemicals, which apparently would have cost only something like $100 a day, which is nothing for a government and for a city the size of Flint, Michigan.
It also shows you, I think, just the extent to which a lot of our old industrial cities are still very much in decline and don't get the attention that they need. I think sometimes there's this picture painted of this renaissance of the cities. People are moving back in, and there's high-tech companies, and there's, you know, cool new restaurants. There's a lot of towns in the Northeast and the Midwest that I think are still suffering very greatly. Flint, Lord knows, has had its share of problems. This is a city of 100,000 people. And a lot of towns like that still are not getting attention, and their people are suffering in many ways.
You know, this is a different version of the two Americas narrative. And for every person who looks at Barack Obama and sees somebody who's eminently reasonable, who is basically putting on his constitutional law professor hat and lecturing us about why are you getting so panicked about all these things, look at the miracle of technology in my 8 years in office, look at the transformation of our city, look at all this, you have an extraordinary gap. And that's what is fueling, we haven't talked about it much today, the Bernie Sanders campaign on the left. You know, Flint, Michigan, this is Democratic territory. It's not Republican territory, but this is the same anger and disconcerted electorate that says, hey, wait a minute, you talk about this dazzling new America, we're not a part of it. Yeah. That's the inequality narrative that Sanders and the leftward poll in the Democratic Party is speaking to right now.
I think it's very important. I'm glad you brought that up, because I have this fantasy that if the parties begin to be led by their most, you know, angriest voices, as it's put, you know, you'll have Bernie Sanders versus Ted Cruz in your election, maybe even a third party candidate at that point.
I have to tell you, I was really struck this week. We haven't talked much about it, but on guns, which, remember, was everything that President Obama talked about last week, his outrage. One of the most dramatic moments of his presidency, right, was the president of the United States openly weeping in tears as he talked about his executive orders to try to do something about this issue that he really hasn't done much on, which is gun control. Then it was reduced to one sentence, by the way, in his State of the Union speech. But so you have the president, tears rolling down his cheeks. There is an unbelievable video, I don't know if you've seen it, where the Duck Dynasty guy is endorsing Ted Cruz. They're both in camouflage, in paint. They're hunting. They're shooting things. They're, you know, and this is the whole reason for the Duck Dynasty endorsement of Ted Cruz. And if you want a better split screen image of the difference in America, think of the president weeping as he thinks of the children who've been killed in these mass shootings. And look at Ted Cruz, who's getting the endorsement of a public figure in Iowa because he was willing to shoot things himself.
Wow. I want to shift gears just a bit, because as you mentioned, the president's painted a pretty picture of the economy and how it's grown. But the first 3 weeks or 2 weeks of the year have not borne that out on Wall Street, where, again, the market's open today and there's a big sell-off and it's considered a pretty wide route. This is the worst first 2 weeks of the year the stock market's ever had.
Well, there's several factors clearly driving this. One is the slowdown in China, slowdown in Asia. Overall, that's clearly causing some of the sell-off. Technology stocks, for example, are down. A lot of those that suggest the interdependency of our economy, number one. Number two, remember that we're looking at almost an oil crash at this point. It's plunged below $30 a barrel, down into $20 a barrel potential territory. That is a major disruption in the global economy.
It's interesting to hear you say that because, of course, most of us think of low oil prices. That's a great thing. But it's obviously having some bad side effects.
It is. It's a good example of the way the economy can be a little bit more complex sometimes than people think. Obviously, it's good to have low gas prices for a lot of people. On the other hand, that's a big industry that employs a lot of people. A lot of companies are now starting to lay people off. They're starting to cut their budgets. There are a lot of industries that depend on that industry. So there's a bit of a ripple effect. And as for China, and before that, the Eurozone, I think it just highlights the way that things can be going relatively well in this country. But unless things are going pretty well in all the major economic Look, the EU and China are the other two big economic regions of the world, and we're connected with them. And to the extent that they don't do well, we suffer. But I do want to say, just in the president's defense, he did make it clear that there are things like technology and globalization that are causing a great deal of anxiety that he said he recognized. So while he, I think, wanted to provide an antidote to some of the apocalyptic descriptions on the other side, he was certainly recognizing that people had legitimate fears.
Well, let me ask this. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say one thing that I think it's important to keep in mind as we hear candidates like John Kasich talk about the Ohio comeback and how great the economy has done in Ohio since he's been governor. And you hear other candidates being blamed for how bad things went when they were governor. I'm thinking of the previous governor of Ohio, who's now running for Senate. You know, the governor of a state has almost nothing to do with an economic crash in this increasingly interconnected global world. The president of the United States also doesn't deserve all the credit he or she will get, or all the blame that he or she will get for an economic up and down. I mean, President Obama does not bear a lot of blame for a 2,000-point dive in the Dow Jones Industrial Average because China is slowing down and oil is more likely to hit 20 than it is to hit 40 in the next couple of months. He probably also doesn't get a lot of the credit, or doesn't deserve a lot of the credit, for halving the unemployment rate. I mean, that's just sort of the nature of a globalized economy. There's not a lot that one person, no matter how powerful he or she is, can actually do.
But there is a lot of credit or blame perhaps to be passed out regarding foreign policy. And that is where the president took a lot of criticism. I'm trying to figure out, is the president underestimating the power of ISIS when he says, look, this is not an existential threat to the United States? Republicans say, look, he doesn't get it. Does he or doesn't he?
Well, he's certainly not wrong to say that ISIS is not an existential threat to the United States, in the sense that they're not going to invade and take over the country. And I think he feels, and a lot of other experts have made similar points, that the overall level of anxiety and fear that's directed toward ISIS and other terrorist groups is not proportional to the actual harm they inflict. It's a delicate thing to say politically, because it sounds like you're minimizing the threat and like you don't understand the menace that's facing the country. But, you know, strictly speaking, it's true. And I think that's, I mean, by the way, the other big issue in terms of foreign policy was this issue of the Iran, of the boat that strayed into, apparently strayed into Iran territorial waters, and this image of American sailors on their knees with Iranian soldiers having guns. And that was this flashpoint to the point that when the first question of the debate to Ted Cruz involved jobs, he ignored it completely so he could have the opportunity to talk about how humiliating it was and how it would never happen under his watch that American, you know, military people were going to be on their knees with their hands up in front of Iranian soldiers.
Well, and let's remember what happened when there was immediately the news right before the president's State of the Union of those boats being held by the Iranians. You would have thought to look at the Republican presidential campaigns and their statements and Twitter that we were facing a new Iran hostage crisis, 300 days. And, of course, that dissipated even within one single news
cycle. Didn't stop Donald Trump from calling the president, saying this is Jimmy Carter stuff, though.
You know, for 5 years I was editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, and I'll tell you, every single foreign policy expert said, you know, when foreign policy mixes with presidential politics, only bad things happen. They used to pray that there would be no conversation about the world in an American campaign.
One would hope that'd be a good thing. And to Naftali's point, by the way, Ted Cruz is an expert at not answering the question you're asked, but answering the question you want to answer.
He's very good.
Just about every single. Remember, in a couple of debates ago, when he took on his all of the other all the moderators, and he said, you know, you're asking me to question Donald Trump's intelligence and whatever. He went down the line and repeated all the attacks against all the other candidates, which was very clever. But he was asked a question about the budget deficit, and he claimed it was a gotcha question. So he's very good at sort of answering the question he wants to answer.
Let's talk to Christopher in Jacksonville, Florida. You're on the air, Christopher.
Look, I mostly wanted to point out how, you know, disingenuous the debate so far has been. So the Republicans framed the debate about the deficit as a moral question. Yet you look at their actual plans that they've put forward. You have, you know, Marco Rubio's plan is projected to cost $4 trillion over the next 10 years. You have even the so-called moderate Jeb Bush's plan is supposed to conservatively come in at $3.2 trillion. You have Donald Trump at $12 trillion and no way to pay for it. So I'm just wondering how long, you know, can the fraud go on? Because this goes back to Paul Ryan, whose plan had lots and lots of magic asterisks.
I want to get a chance to answer your question, Christopher, because I, too, asked myself, how can you say you're going to build up the military, you're going to spend this money, you're already spending $600 billion, how much more are you going to spend? But at the same time, you're going to cut taxes and balance the budget. I don't know how this all adds up.
Yeah, I mean, one of the I guess, benefits for the candidates at this point in the campaign, you know, they're not the incumbent. They don't have to submit actual budgets. They can just talk about all the great things that are going to happen. Usually the response is, well, my tax cuts will create such growth, such unbelievable, incredible, unprecedented growth that the budget deficit will disappear. I think this will become a little tougher as we narrow down and have actual nominees who have to put forth actual plans and get a lot of criticism. Right now there's a lot of hopefuls. There's a lot of proposals out there, and people aren't being pinned down perhaps to the extent that they should be.
Naftali Ben-David, Susan Glasser, Reed Wilson, there are journalists as we talk about the issues that made news in this past week. I'm Derek McGinty. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's continue with a phone call or two before our time runs out. Clay in Norfolk, Virginia, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it greatly. My question is in regards to Ted Cruz's comment about New York values, and I apologize to the panel and to the host for taking us all the way back to the beginning of the show. But when I heard Ted Cruz make his comment last night that the values in New York City are socially liberal, pro-abortion, pro-gay marriage, focus around money and the media, what I heard was veiled anti-Semitism. And I would like to be wrong about this. I would like, you know, to be way off base on this one, not because I like Ted Cruz, but because I think that is abhorrent in the world today.
Well, Clay, you're raising, you know, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of that one, but I wonder what our panelists think.
Oh, I agree. I think it's a longstanding code word. I think it was very purposeful. Ted Cruz is extremely familiar with the map of states that will be coming up early on in the campaign. That being said, it's an irony that Ted Cruz is a very, very vocal supporter of Israel, as are every single other candidate in the Republican field, where it's become the new orthodoxy. So it's not something that you hear that often, which I think is why it did leap out to people. This is something that more belonged in the political conversation of the 1970s. Or earlier, then it really doesn't come up that much anymore. So it struck a weird note.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, too, that Israel has now become a partisan issue where it used to have some semblance of that, but everybody was for Israel back in the day, and now it seems that Republicans are making it their business to say we're more for Israel. I want to just note we got an email regarding the situation in Flint, Michigan. This person, and we got a few emails about it, saying that there was no lead in the Flint River water. As we may have suggested, the lead came from the pipes in the Flint water system, which was leached from the plumbing, not from the river itself. At least that's what they say. So that's something that if we owed a correction, there it is. We don't want to be wrong about that. That's the situation. We also got another email regarding this, which says from Mike in East Lansing. He says, what a horribly misleading description of Flint. These actions were made by a governor-appointed emergency manager who overrode elected officials, saying that the city of Flint did this is disingenuous at best and a lie at worst.
Well, the city switched its water supply. I don't know who made that decision. I assume it was the state and the environmental department that had to make that decision. So,
all right, one more phone call. David in Concord, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. As a Republican, I hope that the Democrats want to make gun control a big issue in the general election. I believe it would put Pennsylvania into play, and I think they would lose Ohio. Like I said, as a Republican, please make it an issue.
All right.
Well, I mean, that might be a little bit of an overstatement. First of all, Republicans have been talking about taking Pennsylvania for as long as I can remember, and they can never quite manage it. But in terms of gun control, you know, the conventional wisdom after the 2000 election, of all things, was that Al Gore had lost in some significant part because of the gun control issue. I think the question now is whether the politics are changing. And a lot of the president's efforts are directed less at passing legislation, which I think he knows is not going to happen, than at trying to shift the political discourse, even just a couple degrees, so that it won't be as politically explosive an issue as it is.
And the polls show that a majority of Americans do support at least some increase in gun control.
When you talk about specific issues surrounding the gun control debate, public opinion is dramatically in favor of them, whether it's universal background checks or banning assault weapons or banning high-capacity magazines. The funny thing is, when you ask Americans, and I think this says a lot about our politics today, when you ask Americans if they support President Obama's actions on guns, which are much less dramatic than any of the three things I just named, a significant portion, a much greater proportion of Americans disapprove of any of those even weaker moves because it's President Obama.
Susan Glasser, you have 30 seconds to have the final word. If you want it. You don't have to.
I still think Donald Trump won't be president, but I can't tell you who's going to win the Republican primaries.
All right. Well, that's as good a final word as any. I want to thank Susan Glasser, editor of Politico, Naftali Ben-David, editor and reporter at The Wall Street Journal, and Reed Wilson, Congress editor and chief political correspondent at Morning Consult. Great conversation, guys. A lot of fun, a lot of information. Also, thanks to you listeners who called us as well. I'm Derek McGinty, and this is The Diane Rehm Show. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Botee, Susan Casey, Danielle Knight, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Douglas Bell. Danielle Brown answers the phones.